Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, wishing you a healthy, productive, and peaceful new year, and welcoming you to the January 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Today's program marks the start of the 11th year of my bringing you Takes on the World on KZYX. Over the past decade, marked by the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, this program has been admittedly controversial, particularly with regard to events in the Middle East and their domestic causes and implications. Today's program will continue in that vein, but with perhaps a different slant for many of my loyal listeners. That's because the subject will be Syria and the ongoing protest against the country's putative dictator Bashar al-Assad that began last March and now, with several thousand more reported deaths, appears to have turned into a bloody civil war with the possibility of a Libyan-style military intervention looming in the future. To be quite frank, I haven't done a program on Syria in all these months because up to now, I've been unable to find someone who I knew and respected who actually been on the ground there and in a communication with those opposing the government and who do not approach the issue with an overriding political bias. Many knowledgeable writers whose opinions I respect have weighed in on the developments in Syria, and most of my opinion have allowed their political biases, many of which I share, to shape their view of the extremely complicated situation as Syria presents itself to outsiders. As we have seen with Libya, foreign, mostly Western or Western-backed elements appear to have taken advantage of the protest to push their own political agendas and turn what began as a peaceful protest into an armed confrontation. With allegations as to who is behind the escalation in violence and the recent deadly suicide bombing in Damascus coming from all directions, it has been difficult to sort out the facts, particularly when the Syrian government restricts the entrance of foreign journalists who are not willing to toady up to the regime. One writer, Aisling Byrne, who had previously worked in Syria, wrote a convincing 11-page article for Counterpunch last week, offering a paper trail to back up its provocative title, quote, "The Neocon Propaganda Machine Pushing Regime Change in Syria." In his article, Byrne quoted the ubiquitous U.S. Undersecretary of State for the Near East, Jeffrey Feltman, who had stated at a congressional hearing that the U.S. would, quote, "relentlessly pursue our two-track strategy of supporting the opposition and diplomatically and financially strangling the Syrian regime until that outcome is achieved," end quote. The blueprint for this, quote, project, he wrote, this is Byrne, is essentially a report produced in 2009 by the pro-Israel Saban Center at the now Israeli-occupied Brookings Institute, calling for regime change in Iran. The report, quote, "Which Path to Persia," unquote, had among its five authors former AIPAC staff member and ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk and Kenneth Pollack, head of the Saban Center, whose book The Gathering Storm is one of the major propaganda efforts supporting the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It is not, however, until the bottom of the eighth page does Byrne concede that, quote, "All of this is not to say there isn't a genuine popular demand for change in Syria against the repressive security-dominated infrastructure that dominates every aspect of people's lives." And Byrne acknowledges that, quote, "the demand for political pluralism and an end to the all-encompassing repression is both vital and urgent," end quote. That's the part we'll hear mostly about today at about 20 minutes past the hour when I discuss the ongoing events in Syria with veteran journalist and one-time 60s activist Reese Ehrlich, who was able to get into the country in October, where most foreign journalists are prohibited, and meet with Syrians who have been in the streets calling for the ouster of Bashar al-Assad and the opening up of Syrian society. With Reese Ehrlich, we will take a look at the opposition and how the current crisis in Syria is viewed very differently by the country's religious minorities. Until then, let's take a look at some other important news that you may not have read or heard. On the 10th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. prison at Guantanamo, let's start with a little noticed action of our Nobel Peace Prize-winning president, who no longer speaks about the promise of candidate Obama to close the notorious prison camp. Last Friday, according to Agence France-Presse, President Obama issued a memorandum to the Secretary of State Clinton and to Congress that he's adding South Sudan to the list of countries eligible to buy weapons from the U.S. At a press briefing at the Pentagon, Obama issued a statement that, after the technical text authorizing the sale concluded, quote, I hereby find that the furnishing of defense articles and defense services to the Republic of South Sudan will strengthen the security of the United States and promote world peace, unquote. And you thought only clowns campaigning for the Republican Party presidential candidacy were beyond satire? What the president will find out, however, as if he didn't already know it, is that the Israelis are already in South Sudan, having had a foothold in that part of the world since the 50s, which they have just recently revived. It didn't help him, not Obama, but it didn't help Newt Gingrich last night in New Hampshire, but Gingrich has been very well paid for his recent comments that the Palestinians are, quote-unquote, an invented people. Sheldon Adelson, the sixth richest person in the United States, last week handed a $5 million check to Winning Our Future, a super PAC run by former Gingrich associates, according to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. A person close to Adelson said that the billionaire planned to spend at least another $5 million during the campaign, either to the Gingrich Link Group or to the winner of the Republican nomination for president, and that the initial check was intended to keep Gingrich competitive in the January 21st South Carolina primary. He had previously contributed $7 million to a foundation set up by Gingrich. Adelson is a close friend of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and is the owner of Israel's most widely circulated publication, Israel Hayom, a free newspaper that functions as a mouthpiece for the Israeli Prime Minister. The American-born Adelson made his billions through the ownership of two Las Vegas casinos and one in Macau, but to judge from the millions of dollars he has given to right-wing pro-Israel organizations in Israel and the U.S., the flag he salutes is clearly not ours. As if Israel's apparent control over Washington's political establishment wasn't enough of a problem, thousands of U.S. servicemen and women will be collaborating with the Israeli military in a major missile defense exercise inside Israel in the next few weeks. The drill is called Austere Challenge 12 and is reportedly designed to improve defense systems and cooperation between the U.S. and Israeli forces. Although it closely follows a 10-day Iranian naval exercise near the strategic Straits of Hormuz, Israeli officials said the exercise with the U.S. was planned long ago and is not tied to recent events. It will, however, be the largest ever joint operation by the two countries and will feature America's Theater High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, missile system, operating alongside its ship-based Aegis system and Israel's own weaponry, the Arrow Patriot and Iron Dome missile defense systems paid for by the U.S. taxpayers. Martin von Krefeld, a well-known military historian in Jerusalem's Hebrew University, said that the drill was intended not only to practice military maneuvers, but also to pressure Iran. Quote, defending against an attack is not something that you improvise from today to tomorrow. It's something you have to prepare, you have to rehearse, you have to prepare for, von Krefeld said. This, among other things, he added, is an excuse to show Iran, the people in Tehran, that Israel and the United States are ready to counterattack, end quote. Counterattack? I'm not sure what world von Krefeld is living in, but it's not Iran that is threatening to attack Israel, but the other way around. U.S. War Secretary Leon Panetta, speaking of this exercise in a speech last month, said it would be an example of unprecedented levels of defense cooperation that the Obama administration has achieved, quote, to back up our unshakable commitment to Israel's security, end quote. How many more American lives that will cost has yet to be estimated. One cause is already become apparent. Oil prices are up on the rise. Pepe Escobar, writing in the Asian Times, describes what he calls a, quote, crash course on how to further wreck the global economy. He says, quote, a key amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act signed by Barack Obama on the last day of 2011 imposes sanctions on any countries or companies that buy Iranian oil and pay for it through Iran's central bank. Starting this summer, anybody who does it is prevented from doing business with the U.S. He goes on, this amendment, for all practical purposes, a declaration of economic war, was brought to you by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, on direct orders of the Israel government under Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu, end quote. That's not an exaggeration on Escobar's part, as listeners who takes on the world are already aware. AIPAC has had a hand in writing every piece of legislation that has to do with Israel's position in the Middle East, including all the sanctions bills, starting with Libya, then Iraq, Syria, and now Iran. Back to Escobar, who noted that, quote, torrents of spin have tried to rationalize it as the Obama administration's plan B, as opposed to letting the Israeli dogs of war conduct a unilateral attack on Iran over its supposed nuclear weapons program. Yet the original Israeli strategy, he writes, was in fact even more hysterical, as in effectively preventing any country or company from paying for imported Iranian oil, with the possible exceptions of China and India. On top of it, he continues, America's Israel firsters were trying to convince anyone who would not that this would not result in relentless oil price hikes, end quote. That's Pepe Escobar in the Asian Times. As you probably noticed, the price of gasoline, which had dropped considerably in recent weeks, is now heading back up there due to the sanctions against Iran and Tehran's threats to block the critical Straits of Hormuz in return. Well, Imperial Britain may no longer be with us, but since Tony Blair joins George W. Bush, Iraq war with equal gusto, it seems anxious to reprise the criminal adventures it conducted in the Middle East in the 20th century, which set the table for all the region's problems today, all of them. Philip Hammond, the UK's latest defense secretary, told delegates at a meeting of the Atlantic Council in Washington last week that Britain will not tolerate an enforced closure of the 34-mile Straits of Hormuz, through which passes 20% of the world's oil. Quote, he said, we are an integrated part of the Naval Task Force in the Gulf, and one of the missions of that task force is to ensure that those shipping lanes remain open. Any attempt to close the Straits of Hormuz would be illegal, and we need to send a very clear message to Iran that we are determined that the strait remain open, end quote. What's not generally known and never mentioned is the fact that the Straits of Hormuz and the waters to the west of it, its crucial shipping lanes, run close to and in some areas through Iran's territorial waters. But under international maritime law, however, the Iranians are entitled to monitor this traffic, but ironically, the traffic, including warships, is entitled to unimpeded transit. This aspect of the law was, no doubt, written at Britain's behest, since for most of the 20th century until 1971, the strait was controlled by the Royal Navy. Well, finally, news from the Walmart front. At the last meeting of the Ukiah Planning Commission, December 11th, the commissioners, with a noticeable lack of enthusiasm, voted 4-1 to accept as adequate, quote-unquote, the final environmental impact report on Walmart's proposed expansion into a 24/7 supermarket, with Linda Sanders being the lone dissenting vote. Then Commission Chair Judy Prudin opened the floor to comments to the public concerning the next step in the process, the approval or rejection of a site development permit that would allow Walmart to begin construction on a 52,000-square-foot addition. Given the anticipated increase in traffic at the already overloaded 101 Talmadge Airport Boulevard interchange and its impact on public safety, should what is essentially a new supermarket on Walmart's current site be approved and constructed, and for which it should be noted there are no funds available to mitigate, the Planning Commission, if it wishes to approve the project, is required by state law to issue a statement of quote-unquote overriding considerations, end quote. Should they do so, the commission would be saying that the need by Ukiah for a new Walmart superstore trumps the danger to public health and safety that would be caused by the increased traffic to the store, not to mention the likely negative economic impact it would have on Ukiah and the county as a whole. The commission was originally scheduled to make a decision on the site permit tonight, but in the wake of its approval of the EIR, an appeal was filed with Ukiah City Council on December 27th by attorney William Copper of Davis, representing the Citizens for Sustainable Commerce, a group of Ukiah residents headed by Steve Scalmanini, Alan Nicholson, and myself. As a result, tonight's meeting of the Planning Commission has been canceled, and instead on January 18th, a week from today, the appeal is scheduled to be heard and decided upon by the Ukiah City Council in its chambers at 300 Seminary Street, the same place, at 6 p.m., although there's a possibility that it will be postponed to a later date. As with the Planning Commission, the City Council will open the floor for public testimony. For more information, you could contact Kim Jordan, the project planner, at 463-2607, 463-2607, or email her at kjordan@cityofukiah.com. That's, once again, that's Kim Jordan at 463-2607, or by email at kjordan@cityofukiah.com.